ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Anthony Burke here, host of By Design, inviting you to check out our new Material Cultures. We're exploring how makers across our region let their materials lead. From bamboo reshaping what's possible in architecture, old timber transformed into contemporary furniture, to ancient traditions like batik reimagined for a new generation. Join me for Material Cultures on Anthony Burke's By Design on ABC Listen.
In this messy, slightly less friendly world, what message do you reckon Australia is sending to our friends and neighbours?
You'd think we might be doing everything we can to build relationships at this point in time, build ties, particularly in this near region.
But there might be one big opportunity that we're missing.
We're about to introduce you to someone who says Australian unis are becoming soulless degree factories, sending thousands of ambitious young people back into this region with a sour taste of Australia.
I'm Kylie Morris.
And in Jakarta this week, I'm Hamish McDonald. Let's go roaming. Well, a very big hello to you there, Kylie, in Australia from here in Jakarta. It's a glorious morning here, a bit smoggy, but it's great to be back. I'm overlooking the Istiqlal Mosque, the national monument for those that know Jakarta, and it's probably over a decade, I think, since I've been here. I've got to say, it's changed a heck of a lot. It's looking incredibly modern. It's looking like one of those big, humming, throbbing Southeast Asian metropolises, but a shiny gleam to it. Kylie.
I'm going to say I'm burning with jealousy from my home studio in Newcastle, which doesn't quite have the same vibe. But I think it's a great reset for us as a program too, Haim, that we're all doing a bit of traveling over the next month or two, especially when I think about the topic we're going to be talking about today, right? Which is about relations with Southeast Asia, but from a perspective we don't normally focus on. Of course, Geraldine and Latika spoke last week with Michael Wesley about his essay, which is his quarterly essay about whether or not Southeast Asia has become a blind spot for Australia and whether our relations are suffering within Southeast Asia. And I guess the interview that we're going to have shortly also focuses on that idea that we are somehow letting ourselves down.
Yeah, I actually wonder whether it's worth introducing a bit of feedback we had from Rob in Melbourne on that very episode with Michael Wesley. Rob says, listen, an interesting argument by your guest on our apparent neglect of Southeast Asia. One way, Rob writes, you could help correct this perceived imbalance would be more coverage of the region on your show. I've always found your program on the topic to be fascinating, although I suppose this dilemma of priorities is one you have to personally confront. Is it currently more important to do shows on Indonesia, say, or the Philippines, or on the Middle East? I think something that I think about a lot, Kylie, is that we often tend to report different regions of the world as sort of standalone puzzle pieces. We don't necessarily always place those pieces in the larger puzzle. So as one example, here in Jakarta, where I am, President Prabowo, you know, is this quite unusual character in that he leads the world's most populous Muslim democracy, but he has chosen to sign up to Donald Trump's Board of Peace. He's offered Indonesian peacekeeping forces to go and be stationed in Gaza as part of this Trump idea of a stabilization force. And just over the last week or so, you know, a number of Indonesian troops killed in Lebanon, serving there under the UN banner. So there are very particular characteristics because there's now a massive blowback domestically here in Indonesia against Prabowo because of his alignment with Trump and obviously the way this is playing out as a kind of Israeli-US war against a Muslim nation.
Indonesia is a past master at walking the tightrope of an unaligned status, right, a non-aligned status between China and the US. And I think what we'll hear from our guest today, Damien Cave, who works for the New York Times, is that Vietnam is doing a very similar thing at the moment when it comes to managing the fallout from the war. But of course, what we're most keen on talking to him about today is an article that he's written and some research he's done with Vietnamese students about why they're choosing not to attend Australian universities, perhaps as much as their parents' generation did, why there is a kind of falling sense of enthusiasm for being an international student in Australia among those Vietnamese students he's spoken to.
Yeah, and I think it's a really important conversation to be having right now because of all of these questions we're being forced to ask ourselves about where we sit in the world. And it is countries like Vietnam and Indonesia and Malaysia and the Philippines that we're going to have to work really hard to ensure that we're getting the settings right on. And I suppose the story that Damien is exploring is whether we're actually letting an enormous opportunity go by because of the way we have restructured the funding model for universities in Australia, placed the emphasis and the pressure on unis to have large numbers of international student cohorts. We talk about it a bit in Australia from the perspective of what this means for Australian students and whether that's diminishing their experience of the universities. But Damien is coming at this afresh and asking, well, what's the experience like for these Asian students that are coming to Australia? You might recall Damien Cave was the Australia correspondent for the New York Times. He's now based in Vietnam. He's the bureau chief, and he's put together this essay for the ABC.
Damien Cave, welcome to Global Roaming.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
So what have you been hearing in terms of Australia's reputation as a destination for education, particularly university education?
You know, it's interesting. Australia has long been a really popular place for people from all over Asia to go to university. But one of the things I've started to notice is that the alumni from decades past are much bigger fans of the Australian education system than current students and more recent alumni. You know, a lot of the people who have been going now kind of feel like they're paying too much and getting too little. It's, as some people said to me, you know, mediocre and overpriced. And so the kind of interest is flagging, I think. And, you know, while there are still lots of students that will go to Australia, I think it's easy to mistake the student numbers for student satisfaction.
So what are the return students who are dissatisfied, who've shared their experiences with you? What are they focused on? What are they missing?
You know, I think what they're missing is a deeper sense of connection both to the academics and to the university community. You know, if you look at global competition, if you look at the University of Edinburgh, McGill, schools in the United States, you know, there's a sense of going to a school and really being incorporated into that school. And the reality is that Australian universities, especially the biggest ones in cities, have become so huge that it's really hard for international students to feel like they're a part of something that's more than just a transactional, take a class, you know, learn something, get a good job experience. And so I think that's what they're kind of seeking and feeling like they're not getting from Australia is really kind of being integrated into the life of the school, the country, and building a community.
It's interesting the way you're describing this because I think often when we talk about the changes in the education system, this very same problem is observed from the point of view of Australian students who are not having the experience on campus that they might have expected. So is it just that the business model is wrong, the dynamics, the ratios are wrong? It doesn't sound like anyone's coming out of this well.
I think you're exactly right. I mean, I think that student satisfaction generally is low. You know, the student satisfaction numbers are below the global average of Australian universities for international students and domestic students. And so something about the model is not working. And there's a lot of conversation in Australia about that for domestic students. But think about it. If you're an international student, you're paying, you know, maybe 10 times as much. You're paying $250,000 Australian dollars for a lot of degrees. And that's a lot of money. And so if you're getting a subpar experience or something, you know, that feels like it's just okay, then it doesn't feel worth it. And I think that's what a lot of students say is if you have another option, go somewhere else besides Australia. And that's not something that Australians are usually used to hearing. You know, they're usually like to see themselves as at the top of the list for desirable places to be. And when it comes to education, that's increasingly not the case anymore.
Damien, is this also partly about the fact that I'm guessing there's a fairly small Vietnamese cohort on campus because there are lots of other international students in greater numbers. Could that be part of the problem, that there isn't a critical mass of these students and so they feel more isolated perhaps than other overseas students might?
I mean, a lot of them sort of talk about the critical mass being just too skewed in one direction, right? And again, global comparisons are helpful. at a school like McGill in Montreal, another global mecca for international students, you know, maybe the Chinese students, for example, maybe the largest group, but only by 100 or 200 students compared to the French students or the American students. At a lot of the big Australian universities, Chinese students are 80% of the international student body and covering, you know, 30 to 50% of the school's revenue. And so, you know, you just have a disproportionate amount. And the numbers are just huge. You know, at UNSW, you know, when Paul Keating opened the International Student Center there in 1999, there, you know, I looked up the numbers and they had about 5,000 international students. Now they have 38,000 international students. You know, that's a full university on its own, just with international students, and it's heavily concentrated in one group or another. And if you talk to education officials, they'll tell you it doesn't mean that Chinese students are the problem or Indian students are the problem. It's that concentration of one group of students that's really the issue. And even a lot of Chinese students want a greater mix. You know, during my reporting, I met a Chinese graduate student who had just come from Japan for doing a study abroad semester. And she was saying that there was so much more deep interaction across different national and ethnic lines at a school in Japan, not known as, you know, a particularly integrated country in terms of immigrants. But she felt like it was better there than it was on her campus in Sydney. And so, again, when you look at these global comparisons, Australia is just not doing as well as it could or should.
I'm interested in your observation about the universities, in a sense, being a frontline tool for Australian foreign policy. And we talk a lot about soft power. I think it's often difficult to really give shape to and define. So for someone that has lived in, worked in, reported on Australia, is now based in Vietnam, how does this translate?
Well, I mean, it's worth remembering that, you know, a university experience is multiple years and a lot of money, and it creates, as one expert told me, you can't underestimate the degree to which it behaves as a connector. And I keep thinking of this story that actually didn't make it into my piece, but at some point I ended up in this small apartment of a communist party official from Ho Chi Minh City. And on the walls were all these photos of his daughter graduating from Western Sydney. I mean, these things were framed in green and yellow. I felt like I was in like an Olympian's home. And here's this guy who dedicated his whole life to the communist revolution. And there was nothing he was more proud of than his daughter graduating from an Australian university. This was many years ago, though. And again, that's the potential, and that's what it can create. And, you know, running around Vietnam and Southeast Asia, when I mentioned that I was in Australia previously, I offer it into people who have, you know, these connections and these relatives who went there. And, you know, there's a lot, like I said, of goodwill, especially deeper into the past. And you just run into it all the time. So you see soft power. I see Australia's soft power frequently in this region connected to universities. And what I think is interesting is the degree to which it appears to be declining over time, at least in terms of the spirit of that connection. Now, you know, maybe older alumni just are more sentimental and emotional than younger alumni, who knows? And there's plenty of people who are from Australian universities who are younger and still succeeding in these countries. But again, it just feels like the potential to really tighten those bonds is being wasted by a university system that ultimately looks at international students as sources of revenue as opposed to sources of connection.
Using education then as the lens, we're often asking ourselves the question at the moment about what relationships we focus on, middle power to middle power relationships in this sort of great power contest era. And, you know, no one needs further explanation about everything that's going on in the world. But is the opportunity there for Australia in Asia, or have we messed this up?
I think the opportunity is still there. And that's why I wanted to write this piece now, is, you know, there's a lot of attention right now on Vietnam, for example, from Australian officials and from the Australian government, because there is a sense that this is another middle power where they can work and partner with them. And I do think that there's still a lot of potential in this region, but it also is at risk of being squandered. You know, as these countries become bigger, more successful, what they're looking for is respect as an equal, not just being seen as a source of revenue or trouble. And when the conversation is solely about immigration and profits from universities, that doesn't work great, you know, in Southeast Asia or anywhere else. And for a lot of these students, you know, someone said to me, at some point you're going to get to the place where the only students who want to come to Australia are those who are really looking for a backdoor to work. You're not going to get the highest caliber students because the top students are going to go elsewhere.
Damien, can I just ask you too, on the supply side then? I mean, you've also been speaking to Australian academics and representative bodies in the universities here. Do they recognise this problem?
You know, a lot of them do actually. I mean, I think especially within the government, some of the officials I talked to, at least on background, would acknowledge that there are some serious problems that they're trying to address and that some universities are dealing with it better than others. There's clearly a distinction between the big urban universities where there's a lot of interest and the experience at smaller universities like Tasmania or elsewhere where the student satisfaction rates are higher and it's not quite as bad. So the officials are definitely aware of it. At the university level, the faculty is extremely aware of this and, you know, will talk your ear off, especially if you don't want to quote them by name, about the problems that they're seeing. And a lot of them are really heartbroken because they feel like the university education is not what it was when they went. You know, they have enormous pride in these institutions and they want to see them do better. But, you know, education globally has become more focused on KPIs and business. And Australia is, yes, within that trend, but also to some degree, a leader of pushing that business perspective in ways that I'm not sure Australia has fully recognized. Like Australia has gone further, faster down this road to corporatizing university than almost any country in the world.
You're listening to Global Roaming from ABC Radio National with Kylie Morris and me, Hamish McDonald. On this episode, I'm in Jakarta. Our guest, Damien Cave, is the Bureau Chief for the New York Times in Vietnam. Coming up on this episode, stick around because we're going to talk about a Trump Tower that's planned for Vietnam and a $1 billion golf course and whether it's connected to tariff negotiations. Damien, I want to ask you about the way the broader global context is unfolding for Vietnam right now. I'm spending some time in Indonesia over the next few weeks, and Prabowo, the president, found himself in pretty tricky situation because of his relationship with Trump, offering to be on the board of peace. Obviously, the whole peacekeeper issue has bubbled up for Indonesia this week, tragically losing a number of soldiers who'd been sent over. How is the conflict in Iran, the issues with the Strait of Hormuz, how is all of this affecting Vietnam?
You know, I think in Vietnam and around the region, there is really a deep sense of frustration that this conflict started thousands of miles away, is having such an enormous impact on Asia. In some ways, this is a Middle Eastern war with Asian consequences. And so, you know, you have rationing of fuel in Vietnam, you have rationing of fuel all over Asia, and it's creating this kind of zero-sum contest where, you know, from the level of a gas station attendant in the Mekong who's trying to decide which farmer gets the diesel that he has, the small amount of diesel that he has, to countries like Vietnam going all over to any country in the world, China, the United States, saying, hey, can we get some fuel? Can we get some gas? And so, you know, you're creating this sort of tension and contest between countries and between people because of a conflict started by the world's largest producer of oil and gas against another oil titan, with the consequences being really severe in Asia in particular. And Vietnam is definitely feeling it. Flights are going to get canceled. You know, there's arguments at gas stations. Like, we're seeing a lot of tension here, and I think it's happening throughout the region.
Can Vietnam get any help from China? It has a very close trading relationship there.
Yeah, you know, a source that I talked to, a diplomat who I spoke to yesterday, said that Vietnam has gone to China hat in hand and said, hey, we could really use some refined fuels. And this was early in the war. And I'm told China basically said, well, you joined Trump's Board of Peace, so too bad for you. So you're seeing this kind of jockeying in the U.S.-China contest with countries like Vietnam trying to figure out what is exactly the balance that's needed to keep their economy going and to get what they need from both of these superpowers. I think the war in Iran is making that a lot harder for a lot of countries.
Is there any discussion in Southeast Asia about whether different supply chains could be established with these resources? Like, plenty of oil in the Malaysia territories, Brunei, some in off Indonesia. Obviously, Australia has a lot of LNG. Is there much discussion about whether this region could supply itself in a way that's less dependent on the Middle East?
You know, there are discussions about that. But what's interesting, right, is the system has been set up for a lot of crude from the Middle East. And it's not all the same, right? Some crude has more sulfur than others. And so there are a lot of conversations in Vietnam and elsewhere about, well, what kind of mix can we get to work at the refineries that we have? Like, the infrastructure of oil and gas in the region has been set up in a certain way. And to shift towards more regional sources is a grinding, really difficult process of chemistry and sourcing and mixing of fuels. And so there's conversations about that. It doesn't feel like it's an immediate solution. And, you know, even then, if you do change to regional sources, well, how secure are those, right? And so oil and gas for more than a century has been a choke point, and it continues to be a choke point no matter where you get it from.
It comes at a particularly tricky moment, doesn't it, for Vietnam's leader, for Tho Lam. I mean, he's promised to super boost economic growth. He's talking about 10% increase in GDP by 2030. This is destined to put a huge dent in that ambition, isn't it?
Well, I think that's what everyone's trying to figure out, is to what extent does it affect an economy that's really heating up and continuing to grow? And one of the questions that I think is coming up with a fuel shortage is, okay, well, who gets the fuel? Is it the electronics manufacturers? Is it the farmers in the Mekong that produce 95% of the rice exports for Vietnam? Is it the cities where people in finance really don't want to not be able to get to work? And so this is the kind of question that I think you're seeing in a lot of places, is what's the best place to target energy if you only have a limited amount of it? And also, what kinds of deals do you need to make with different countries, and what do you have to give up to get enough fuel to keep that economy going? You know, Vietnam has a pretty close relationship to Russia. They just made a deal to create nuclear power plants in Vietnam. And so maybe that benefits Vietnam slightly. But all of these relationships that have been going on throughout history for Vietnam and others are now being, the threads are being pulled in an effort to kind of keep the economy going.
I was surprised traveling to Vietnam last year how, I guess, relaxed people were about this transactional environment when it comes to global politics. Because I guess from an outsider looking in, you see Trump threatens to whack 46% tariffs on Vietnam. That's disastrous for an export economy. But then just anecdotally talking to people, they were like, well, you know, his son's been here. We're going to build a tower in Ho Chi Minh City. There's going to be a Trump tower. There's going to be a big Trump golf course resort thing. It's okay. It'll all come. It'll be worked out.
I mean, you're not going to find a country that's more resilient and optimistic in Asia or maybe the world than Vietnam. Whatever they're dealing with now, they've dealt with worse. And so, you know, that's kind of the attitude that drives this country and drives the economy. So there is a feeling that, like, well, we'll figure out a way no matter what it is. And they're probably not wrong. But that said, there's also increasing frustration with Trump in particular. I mean, I hear a lot from officials about how promises were made about, say, that Trump golf course where other financiers were supposed to come in, and now they haven't. So Vietnamese banks are on the hook for it. And so you're seeing gradually this kind of distrust in American promises that is increasing. And whether or not that affects Vietnam's sort of alignment is something that's going to, we'll continue to see. I mean, it still needs the U.S. to sell stuff.
Just for listeners who are not across it, like, how big is this golf course? What is it worth?
So it's, I can't remember the numbers. It's more than $1 billion. And it's in this area north of Hanoi where there's all these farms. And basically the Trumps and a particular developer have decided to build this enormous luxury golf course and basically a small city and mixed use development. And Eric Trump came here and for a groundbreaking and said, it's going to be amazing. And this is going to help your relationship with the United States. This was right as tariffs were being negotiated. And now it's still sort of a question mark as to what happens with it. And like a lot of Trump deals, you know, it's a lot of fanfare at the beginning and the follow through as well, a little bit questionable.
But they did get the tariffs down, right? They didn't end up with 46% tariffs.
They did get the tariffs down to 19-20%, and it maybe it helped, maybe it didn't, you know. But the thing that Vietnam is dealing with and the whole world is dealing with is there's just so much volatility, right? And so tariffs that they got down are now at a relatively even level because the Supreme Court threw them out. So all Vietnam really cares about is that they're cheaper than China. And that's no longer the case. If the tariffs are flat across all the different countries, then Vietnam becomes less competitive than China. And so it's that uncertainty that I think is a real threat to this economy and others. You know, when do you invest? Are prices going to go up for fuel or down? The paralysis that I kind of see in decision-making is the greater risk for Vietnam and lots of countries in Asia.
Damien, you're an American in Vietnam in a moment when America has launched another war, this time in the Middle East. The Vietnamese are very open in talking about their history with America and the American war, as they call it. What are people saying to you? I mean, do they see this as another example of American adventurism, but this time in the Middle East?
I do think they see it that way. I mean, they're familiar with an America that doesn't recognize a quagmire when they're in it. They're familiar with an America that feels as though it can throw its weight around in ways that it often cannot. And so I don't think anyone in Vietnam is especially surprised by what the United States is doing in Iran, but the severity of the consequences are what's driving people crazy. You know, someone I talked to, an old farmer, said to me, like, I don't know if these leaders are crazy or what's going on, but it just doesn't make sense. And so I think that's the question that a lot of people in these pragmatic, business-oriented countries is, you know, you're going to tank the whole global economy, including Asia, thousands of miles away because of a conflict that didn't necessarily need to be started. So I think it's that question about the absurdity of the experience that I hear quite a bit in Vietnam, even more than anger or outrage. I mean, people here are just, again, trying to figure it out and find solutions and adapt, because that's what they do.
Damien, it's always great to chat with you. Thanks for giving us such a fresh and interesting and provocative perspective.
Thanks for having me. I love the show.
Hamish, I thought that was terrific. I've got to say, the idea of taking the train from Hanoi to Sapa, the northern border, and seeing a Trump Tower and golf course right next to the rail line is slightly giving me a bit of a sick feeling. But apart from that, the thing that really struck me was that anecdote that he had about the Vietnamese official going to China and saying, or checking with a counterpart and saying, hey, if we really need some help from you, will it be forthcoming? And him getting that answer that, well, you guys, you know, signed up to the Board of Peace, so sorry.
Mm. Yeah, look, and maybe this conversation presents an opportunity for us actually as a nation to consider what these human-to-human relationships and bonds offer us in terms of adapting to the new geopolitical environment. If our neighbours are studied and experienced and highly competent at more transactional international relations, maybe as we kind of enter into this new era, we can lean on some of that knowledge, that insight, that wisdom to help us navigate a world in which perhaps values as a basis for alliances may not count quite so much.
We would really love to hear your thoughts on that. So don't forget to write to us. We love your questions and feedback. Our email is global.roaming@abc.net.au.
I actually wanted to throw in one bit of feedback from Suzanne, who said, love the program, utterly rusted on. So thank you, Suzanne. But recently, Hamish mentioned the bees influencing our perceptions of Southeast Asia, particularly Indonesia. He described Bali bongs and beers. I actually said bombs, just to be clear, not bongs. But Suzanne says he forgot the fourth. It should be B for Balibo. Maybe that's part of our contested history. Or is it a case of don't mention the war? I think inputs and legitimacy have to be built on trust, which is based on truth. Truth in terms of contested history doesn't need to be confrontational or aggressive. Look, I'm not sure, actually, honestly, Susan, the degree to which Balibo still shapes our relationship with Indonesia. I think a lot of work has been done to try and acknowledge that history, but also move past it. And I think actually when we spoke to Janana Guzmao a year or two back here on Global Roaming, I was so fascinated about the level of forgiveness that exists between East Timor and Indonesia's leaders, particularly when you consider that Prabowo is now the president and the role that he had in East Timor when it was under Indonesian occupation. So again, maybe another lesson from our region about moving forward, finding the way, being pragmatic in these complicated times.
Hamish, tomorrow Geraldine and Latika are back with more on the situation in Iran. They'll be talking strategy and statecraft with Jack Watling from the Royal United Services Institute in London. He's got a new book out and some new ideas about how you might open the Strait of Hormuz. So that's one not to miss. Now, I know that you're going off and doing more exciting things in Indonesia, Hamish, and I've been practicing Hati Hati di Jalan.
Stay safe on your journey.
Yeah, travel well, travel well. There you go. It worked.
See you next time, Kylie.
Bye-bye.